The other thing that came out of that conversation is something you and I have talked about a bit, which is positioning agency leaders themselves as these kind of domain experts, these visible experts, building reputation in this new environment. Do you think there's an appetite for that?
Well, there's one for my appetite for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know, I got, you know, Casey on my team now looking at, you know, HMA and Abby as an entity, as a client, and what are we doing to elevate the knowledge and expertise in a, obviously in a way that ultimately may lead to new business development, but really about positioning. And it came really from conversations that you and I have had about what is executive thought leadership and what does it mean in today's way of doing some things, and you know, establishing your executive and your leader as a brand, and what, how do you do that? And as you said, people don't hire logos, they hire people. So how do we think in that same sense, but apply it to the human component? And one of the things that she and I have been talking about, and it's really a little bit of practicing what we preach, is there are countless ways to position me as the individual or any executive leader into places, right? You can write articles for trade associations. You can give speaking engagements. You can win awards or, you know, present at conferences, all these kind of things. All great. I mean, those are all wonderful things. They all are time intensive to be successful and make them worthy and having something important to say. And being in the right place, so that takes some research. I mean, you know, we can go speak all day long, but if the people in the audience aren't the right people, then there's no point in doing it. And then the actual hard costs that are associated with some of these things. You know, I will receive an award, and the award program is in New York City, and that means going and airplane and hotel and new dress and a very expensive, you know, rubber chicken lunch. But I'm going to go because it is the positioning of that particular entity that says Abby should be in the room in that place. So when you're looking at doing these things, you have to evaluate all of what goes into it, right? It's not, it probably takes an hour to put the, you know, the nomination packet together, but it could be, you know, 50 hours worth of implementation once you've won, right? Between what you have to fulfill, the deliverables you need to do and such. So there's a lot that goes into it. Personally, I've been intrigued by the conversations that you and I have had in terms of thinking about it that way, in that executive thought leadership in today's knowledge sharing has to be thought of a little bit differently. It isn't just write the article anymore. I mean, there has to be a lot more behind it. And we've always believed, kind of with any new platform, if you will, we need to try it out ourselves first before we make a strong statement that this is the way to do it for a particular client. And so we're going to see how to do it. The first of the year gave us a great chance to say, okay, here's what is ahead. Here's where we're going to invest actual dollars. Here's where we're going to, you know, spend some money to, you know, have a presence. These are the topics that, you know, I feel comfortable saying I can be an expert on it. These are the industries that we know we can be good in. And then what's our plan to get there?
When you think about the investments that you'll make over the year, what categories are there?
So from a time perspective, you know, we are talking about content development. So here are, I think there's 6 or 8 topics right now that we're working on that says that I feel comfortable that I can be an expert on this topic, that I have enough knowledge of it, and that I feel that I can stand up in front of a room and say these things and be considered an authority on the particular topic. So we're creating some content. We've looked at across the year the industry media and award opportunities. So those things that recognize public relations agency leaders, PR practitioners, women in leadership, and say, these are the ones that we think are worthy based on who it represents, that we think we have a decent chance of being considered for that. The and but part of that is then there's usually a cost associated, because if you win, you have to, you know, participate. So we were a little bit more selective looking at that as the other deciding factor. And then the third area is nothing to do with PR specifically and positioning for woman, business leader, successful business, you know, that where the voice could, where being a voice in business matters, and or a voice in nonprofit leadership or a voice in cultural affairs, you know, things that are important to me and where to do that. So it kind of falls into those couple buckets. One of the things that we did differently this time than what we've done before is we've always counted HMA as a client, but it's always been the bottom of the list client. So everybody else, which, you know, I mean, obviously they should.
The redheaded stepchild.
Right. You know, in the event that we have to pick, we're always going to pick the client, the paying client over the agency, and we will still do that. But Casey has been tasked with a set number of hours and a set number of deliverables that say, this is what we want to try to accomplish. And we need to report in on it in the same way that we would if we were, because in theory, there might be a money exchange in order for it to happen, but the time investment is money and there will be money.
That's right.
And ultimately,
it's absolutely money. You're paying her and she's using hours to do that. It's money. Yeah.
And I do want some measurable results, but as I've said to her, it won't take a lot for this to be considered successful. I can only take on a certain amount of new business in a given year with the team that I have in place and the structure that we currently are. So we aren't looking for hundreds and hundreds of new clients. I'm looking for 3, 5, 8, 10, whatever the number is, solid, strategic organizations that want to invest in this and want us to be the ones doing it for them. So success can be very easily measured and attainable. And if we're thinking about what are our performance indicators, what are we going to do when we say we've invested this over here, what did it result in? It will be very obvious when it happens.
Can you say more specifically about that? How will you know?
Will I know?
And what I mean, I think this is what you're saying, but let me say it out loud and you correct it if it's not what you're saying. So if the brand and reputation of Abby Fink and HMA Public Relations are elevated and strengthened, and that creates more credibility and trust, how will that show up?
Okay, it'll show up for me in a increase in inbound inquiries for potential client work in targeted industries. So it'll you know, we would like a architecture firm as a client. And as a result of these activities, speaking engagement or attending the conference, whatever it will be, we had 3 conversations with directors of marketing at architecture firms. That is a win. A legitimate conversation is a win. Did we convert to new business? That's on me to do that in the sales process, right? So Casey's responsibility and her measurement is bringing that opportunity to the table. What we do with it then becomes a different conversation. I am not going to measure success in how many awards do we win, because that is not a true indicator in the sense of, oh, we won 50 awards this year. I want to be focused on entering for the work we do for our clients. So I would like our work on behalf of organizations that we represent to be recognized. I would like our agency to be recognized in the categories that we are excelling in. And then, you know, where where does it make sense for an agency like ours with leadership that we have to be positioned? And so it's not, winning is nice. Don't get me wrong. I want to win, but I want to be in the room with the type of individuals that I respect and that I want them to see me in that same light, and that we are in a room of like-minded business leaders at the appropriate time. The dollars and cents part, you know, look, we're going to spend some money. Would I want to make sure I get it back? Sure. But there are certain things that are beyond our control. I can do 50 new business proposals. I can meet with 100 different CEOs, and none of them can turn into an actual contract. Or I could meet with one in a 10-minute phone call and or sign in a contract. So the sales funnel is a funny thing, and the cycle of it is a funny thing. All I can ask my team to do is get us in at the table, get us in the room, get us the conversation, and then let our experience and our knowledge, you know, carry us forward.
One of the things that's so critical in this kind of initiative is understanding the signals that create trust and credibility with both humans and machines. So this is the kick that I've been on, the thing that I've been talking about. And those signals need to have some clarity to them. So that's the technical layer, actually. It provides this clarity. So connecting together entities, relationships. Abby Fink is the owner and president of HMA Public Relations, which is a PR firm in Arizona. Like, these are all, you know, nouns and relationships that need to be explicitly drawn. Those are the easy ones. Those are probably already the machine, the Googles of the world have figured that out already. But when you publish something, or when you're featured on a podcast, or when you win an award, are those signals adding to the weight of it? Or is that some other Abby Fink who did some disconnected thing in the eyes of the machines? And if it's not connected in the eyes of the machines, it's hard for it to be connected in the eyes of the people, because ultimately the people are the point here. So the clarity of those connections is really important. And then, of course, consistency, you know, beginning to do these things. And then the one that really, really seals the deal here is corroboration, right? Do other non-related entities agree that Abby Fink of HMA Public Relations is an expert on X topic? And so there's what someone working in this field has called the infinite loop of self-corroboration. In other words, you're creating things intentionally and then also putting things out there intentionally that then get linked back to these things and creates this corroboration loop. That's when because these algorithms are mathematical, they are doing something different than humans. Humans are making our assessment of trust on the basis of all kinds of things, which you already know about, you know, authenticity, resonance, you know, do I like this person? Does this make sense to me? Did other people that I respect tell me that this person is, you know, a trusted advisor, an expert I should, you know, go to, whatever. The machines are not doing that on that kind of feeling or assessment kind of, they're literally doing it on the basis of calculations and a confidence score, right? Can we say with any level of certainty that this person is likely to be who someone who just typed something into the search bar or the chat, you know, the ChatGPT window? What's our confidence? The machines are thinking, not really thinking, but they're calculating. What's our confidence that this is the answer they need, right? So that's what makes this so interesting to me, is the old school, you know, what I said to you in the meeting is that the real secret sauce you couldn't give away, because it is you and this embodied knowledge, experience, and expertise, the filters through which you look at the world, like that's yours, and people can only get that by interacting directly with you. So that's the real value there. Will the machines know that you have that to the point where they will say to somebody who says, hey, I need to find a PR firm in Arizona, oh, you need to talk to HMA, right? that's the thing that we have to build. And I'm getting quite passionate about this core idea that we, I was going to say delegated, but that's not it. We relegate, like we left this to SEO firms for most of the past 15 or 20 years, thinking they're the ones that do the online, the technical, the digital, that, you know, they're in the back end of the websites doing whatever mysterious voodoo they do.
The voodoo that they do?
How do they do the voodoo that they do so well? So I think at least some level of awareness of how this all works is required for that conductor role. You know, you don't have to be able to play every instrument in the orchestra. You have to know the notes, right? You have
yep.
to know, and what they should sound like. And that's why I was saying in the Nashville meetings, if you have an SEO firm talking to you at all about keywords and links and content, they are out of touch. Those things are still part of the mix, but they are not the point. They haven't been the point for long enough that it should now be offensive.
I've said this before, and you know, when that stuff kind of came out, SEO, social, digital, whatever we were calling all of that at the time, it was a vendor-supported activity. Like, it was something that we paid someone to do. They had a knowledge and expertise because they elevated themselves to that level. And we said, great, you worry about that, and we're going to worry about this, and we'll meet once a month, and we'll make sure whatever we're doing and what you're doing kind of goes together. And that worked. I mean, it worked for what it was. I think we learned some very valuable lessons in who we put in charge of those extremely important assets that we had, and how important it was that your LinkedIn profile mirrored what you said you were doing. You know, I mean, that there was truth in everything. And we learned and we got smarter about what we were doing. And we realized that, you know, these incredibly powerful tools have to be incorporated into a larger strategy. And there are still going to be, we're not done learning about these things. I mean, every day there's another study you can look at about the impact of, you know, machine learning and how it's changing and what we're doing and how we're using it and the comfort level. And, you know, I just answered a survey from my business insurance company asking me, would I buy insurance from an AI recommended, you know, platform? And well, the fact that you're asking me in a survey that I'm answering online tells you to some extent I'm comfortable giving you this information in an online platform. But I still answered for, you know, yes to getting recommendations, yes to doing a cost comparison. But when it came down to actually buying it, I wanted to talk to somebody. I'm about to spend some money. I want to talk to somebody. Now, ask me those same questions a year from now, I might change my mind because I, you know, not to throw my mom out there as a great example as of a technologist, because she's the last person in the world to want to use technology. But I can remember when she would first got comfortable with the idea of booking an airline ticket online, but she would still call the airline just to make sure it went through because clearly the computer couldn't have possibly gotten it right. And I'm not entirely sure that she still doesn't wonder if she should pick up the phone sometimes and make that phone call, but that's generational and that's trust in the system and those kind of things. So the idea that the conductor concept, and we don't have to know how to do it all, we just need to be the one sort of orchestrating the process, couldn't actually be more relevant. I just went to see the symphony not too long ago, and I was fascinated actually by the conductor, who was up there having a fantastic time, making sure that the violinist came in at the right time and the bass player did what she needed to do, and that, you know, and that the first chair of this and he's just up there with his baton, you know, doing everything, having the best time, working equally as hard to make sure that all of the people on that stage were doing their part. And the, you know, the first chair violinist had her responsibility, and the first chair trombonist had his responsibility, and the conductor made sure they both knew what they were supposed to do. And a perfect metaphor for what you are describing in terms of, you know, how we as PR practitioners and counselors in this conversation need to really be thinking is how do we conduct all of these things that we have? How do we make them make beautiful music and bring to us, you know, whatever it is that the goal is? You ask me, how will I know if I'm being successful? Well, I guess to carry this on is we'll have a well-orchestrated activity that each of those parts plays to bring forth this important part, which for me, again, is to the extent that it brings in new business and it elevates our agency on topics that we feel are important for us to be recognized, literally recognized for, but that the various algorithms that are putting together the dots and the dashes to find us also see that same thing. And if we can do that successfully, then we see, you know, the kind of results that I'm hoping for, and I believe that we will.
I mean, it's interesting too, because if you think about reputation and how this used to be built versus this digitally mediated and even now AI mediated environment, reputation was based on knowing about you and knowing a bit about your past. You know, reputation can't be just created in the present moment. I believe expertise can be demonstrated in the present moment. You know, if I'm having an emergency and somebody shows up and I know nothing about them, don't know their name, don't know their history, have never looked at their LinkedIn profile, never seen their resume, but they are clearly in that moment demonstrating competence, you know, decisiveness. They know exactly what's going on. They get in there and they start to help. That person has just earned the label expert, you know, credible. And in the future, if I saw them again, I would be likely to trust them. But they don't have a reputation to me until I start talking about them to other people. And I start sharing with those other people about this, you know, you're never going to believe what happened, this thing, and the person showed up and there they were. It was amazing. Like, they totally took charge of the situation, whatever, whatever. I don't know what the scenario is that I'm even imagining. It started out in my mind being a flat tire, but then it grew into something much more serious.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, the doctor, the car accident. Yeah, I had that same vision.
Or, you know, you're on a flight and I have been a few times when they've needed medical personnel on the plane, right? Is there a doctor on the plane? Is there anyone on the plane? I am a doctor, but not a physician, so I do not raise my hand in those situations. But again, somebody comes up, they're not going to check, you know, your credentials. They're not going to look up your, you know, Yelp reviews. It's, you know, can you assess the situation? Do you understand what's happening with this person? And, you know, mostly that's demonstrated by getting to work,
doing
your thing, mm-hmm. right? Checking vitals, speaking to the person a particular way that demonstrates, hey, I understand these situations. I know what I'm doing. I will help navigate through this. So that's expertise. The interesting thing to me about how reputation and reputation management in our world, PR and media and communications, is there has not been much of an attempt to consolidate the past credibility and really build this almost unassailable foundation. I suspect probably some reputation management firms do this, although sometimes they are reactionary. Their client engagements or reaction, somebody comes to them because, you know, they need to bury a review or a article that was written, you know, a hatchet job of some kind. And they're like, you know, this isn't even true. We got to deal with this. What I would like to also see is people understanding exactly how to put those already existing assets together in a way that starts to signal to the machine. So everything that you said in your plan with Casey is proactive. Okay, this year, here are the activities, here are the domains, here are the topics, right? Here are some of the tactical things. And then there's the question of Abby Fink has been in this business for a long time and already has a ton of media appearances and speeches and awards and right? And so another piece of this that I also want PR firms to understand as a potential service offering to their clients, but again, it would be great if they understood how to do it because they'd done it for themselves first, how to assemble the kind of optimized page. So the specific example is like a newsroom page or a press page on a website. It's one thing to have one. A lot of people don't even have that and it should be there. But it's another thing to have that optimized for the kind of legibility that we're talking about. Like the machines look at the page and go, oh, I get, like, this is corroborating the topical authority of this person. And so part of that happens on the front side of the page, the part that people read. And part of it happens on the back end of the page, the schema markup and, you know, the hierarchy and things that the machines read. Because machines don't read all the text on the front of the page. They kind of chunk and skim and read the first few words, read the last few words, and make up the middle. Kind of like how we listen to speeches. We listen to the beginning, we listen to the end. The middle is kind of mushy. But that's also not a core PR skill per se. Like that's what I'm describing. Like I think you would know it when you saw it if you had some guidance or, you know, playbook or checklist or something. But that's another thing that I've been thinking about. Like how would you, for example, consolidate all of that existing material in ways that would almost kickstart, because you'd be starting from up here instead of somewhere else.
You know, what's interesting in that question, I don't know the answer specifically how I'll do it, but, you know, in getting ready for Casey and I to have this discussion, one of the things she did was went backwards in time and, you know, looked at the blog posts that I had written before and what were some of the themes that I had written about and did I already have content available on a particular subject that we would need to update and revise. I mean, you can't rely heavily on your old stuff. You know, where's the bio that lists all of the, you know, engagements, opportunities, speaking engagements, awards won, whatever, you know, the whatever you've got, the CV of all the activities you've done. So to the extent that we think about it, you know, we probably can pull all that together. What we do with it then is the next step, is what does it do? Does it live in its own separate website? Does it have its own platform somewhere? You know, I don't necessarily have it all wrapped up and figured out, but I think that's what we have to talk about. The other part of this that is a little bit uncomfortable and a little bit part of what you have to realize is doing this requires you to think of yourself as the product, as the brand, and allowing some of that to guide how you're going to make some of these, you know, decisions and put what you're going to put forward, right? It's not always a comfortable position to be in to say, I'm really great at this and don't you think so too? And
by the way, I think that's another good argument for why having outside support on a project like this really makes a lot of sense. Just like your clients would not want to grab the spot. Some of them
exactly
will.
Exactly. Right. But that's why they hire us, right? Is they recognize they need to do these things, but they don't know how to do it or what to do. And it is a lot easier for someone else to identify and say, Adrian, you're really good at these things and I want to push this out versus you saying, I'm really good at this and I want you to push this. I mean, it feels
beyond
different.
Even the knowing what to do and how to do it, it's what you started talking about, which is this sense of, you know, humility that you know you should have. And some of this feels maybe a bit like attention seeking or something unpleasant. And I've always said, you know, I've been working with leaders on personal storytelling projects for years. And I was like, I don't know if, you know, I don't want to be like that person. And I said, the good news is the fact that you even feel that way means you never will be. Because the narcissists never question any of this. They're just like, yeah, of course. Like I'm the best and I should be out there in front of everyone. So
there's the 10 things that I'm the best at, actually. Not
you forgot
there's
one.
All the things you should do that I'm amazing at.
And here's the key difference. And this is the difference that makes a difference. What we're talking about here in 2026 with reputation and trust and credibility in the age of AI has to be the kind of credibility you can't fake. And that's good news, because people who are careful and humble, who will not want to brag, are the best candidates for building a real reputation, not a overinflated, you know, kind of self-serving kind of a thing. So that's, I don't know if that helps, but it does. I have definitely noticed that it is the people who are the most hesitant to kind of step into the spotlight that I never really worry about, because I know you'll come from truth and integrity and, you know, a willingness to serve and all the things. And yet it's hard sometimes to get over that hesitation, because we were all raised, you know, don't stand out, don't hog the attention, you know, all the things. I don't know. What are your thoughts
on that? Be humble and kind, in the words of Tim McGraw, be humble and kind. But I think, you know, I believe you're right, though, in that sense. And if from a trust perspective, from a willingness to follow, willingness to listen, all of that can't be faked. And those of us in a position to be able to lead in a way and to be able to be talking and being trusted in that sense, it is my belief that it is our responsibility to recognize that what is being entrusted to us, and we owe it out there to protect that and manage it in such a way that it is genuine, it is sincere, it is coming from the right place, because we all have a BS meter and can figure it out when it's not. And so if we are going to be in a position to have that leadership responsibility and create some authority and be seen in that way, we have to recognize the responsibility that comes along with that, because we are creating influence and we are setting a path for others to follow along with whatever it is that we are out there talking about, and we need to be responsible for what we're putting out there.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Copper State of Mind. If you enjoyed the conversation, please share it with a colleague who might also find this podcast valuable. It's easy to do. Just click the share button in the app you're listening to now to pass it along. You can also follow Copper State of Mind in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other podcast app. We publish new episodes every other Friday. Copper State of Mind is brought to you by HMA Public Relations, the oldest continuously operating PR firm in Arizona. The show is recorded and produced by the team at Speed of Story, a B2B communications firm in Phoenix, and distributed by PHX.fm, the leading independent B2B podcast network in Arizona. For all of us here at Speed of Story and PHX.fm, I'm Adrian McIntyre. Thanks for listening and for sharing the show with others if you choose to do so. We hope you'll join us again for another episode of Copper State of Mind.